I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
This episode is brought to you by Tabard Inn, new American cuisine in one of Washington, D.C.'s oldest hotels, located in DuPont Circle. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Cooking in Mexican from A to Z. I'm one of your hosts, Aaron Sanchez, alongside my beautiful mother,
Zarela Martinez.
And, of course, we're broadcasting on Heritage Radio Network, HRN, who allow us to be able to transmit all these beautiful messages about food, culture, lifestyle, and all that good stuff. And we just want everyone to be able to kind of embrace this beautiful mission about food and all the artisanal people behind it, and wine and tequila and all that good stuff. So today we have the really distinct pleasure of inviting somebody that's going to speak to us about a subject matter that I think is really important, I think is overlooked a lot of times as far as its building blocks for Mexican food and ingredients and just needs the love. Of course, we're talking about Carlos Yescas. He's here visiting from us all the way from Newcastle, England, Great Britain. We're really excited to have him. Let me just wax a little bit poetic about this gentleman, because he is really somebody special. He's a food scholar, obviously, conducting extensive doctoral research and on the principles and relegations of cheese. He's the co-founder of Lactographia Cheesemonger, forgive my pronunciation. But he's also the first artisan cheese distribution company in Mexico. He is the co-founder of Lacteo, a Latin American platform that through education and instruction, we seek better conditions for artisanal cheesemakers in the regions and their communities and empower local consumers to recognize the quality of local and foreign products. This is beautiful, because he's also acknowledging all of the and trying to create this beautiful network and making sure that everyone has the proper recognition that they deserve, which is awesome. He also published his wonderful book called Quesos Mexicano in 2013. And his work has been a subject matter of an episode of Taste of Mexico with our dear friend, of course, Chef Rick Bayless, which we all love and care for so much. And Carlos has traveled throughout the Western world documenting cheese traditions and the stories and currently researching raw milk use in cheesemongering around the world. And hopefully we can talk about that, because the idea of pasteurizing cheeses and all that good stuff. So we're going to kind of touch upon cremas, requesón, panela, and artisanal cheeses in the Mexican diaspora. So everybody, please welcome Carlos Yesca. Órale!
Thank you, Aaron. Thank you, Sarela, so much. What a wonderful introduction. I'm so excited to be with you in this radio show. Pardon my voice. I have had a cold for the past 2 weeks. It's getting better. It's not COVID, but we're all set to go here.
Outstanding. I'm
thrilled to be able to learn directly from the master, because we had Paula Lambert here, who does Mexican style cheeses, and charming as she is and adorable as she is, they're not the Mexican cheeses that you know, that we know and love, and that we wonder why they are not available in the United States. And I think Carlos is going to be able to tell us that. And I'm so excited to have you here. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Sarela. Yeah, I'm very excited to talk. I also love Paula Lambert. We have traveled together in Europe, learned about some of the traditions of cheese in Italy together, actually. So we're good friends, and I'm very happy that you already have her. And I hope I can bring something different than what she already shared with you.
So, Carlos, how do you think we should begin about this? So should we start to tackle the subject with the crema and then kind of go up from there as far as, like, sort of, you know, do things derive from there? Like, how do you want to, how can we start best?
So I think always the best place to start when we're talking about cheese and dairy is milk, actually. You know, it seems obvious, but it's but normally we stop thinking about milk the moment we start thinking about queso or crema, you know, and really it's milk that we have to pay attention. You can make good crema, you can make good queso, you can make good anything if you have good milk. And people normally say, you know, you have to have good milk, but then no one explains you what good milk actually is, which is kind of like annoying. Like, oh, you're looking for quality products and you're like, what does that even mean? So quality products in milk is very, very easy. It's a bit scientific and a bit romantic. In the scientific side is you need to have good amount of fat and good amount of protein. And you build fat and protein in two ways. You build it by feeding your animals correctly, and that's how you build fat. And you build protein by giving your animals enough exercise, right? This is crazy because most people think that, you know, cows are just there to be standing, but actually cows and sheep and goat that are playing, walking around and everything produce better milk because they have better, higher contents of protein. That's why when we talk about quality milk, we're also talking about husbandry practices, you know, taking care of your animals in a humane way so they can move around, they can eat good, and so you end up with better milk. And so that's kind of the beginning of all of the conversation that we can have about crema and everything else.
But are there systems in place that regulate the quality of milk? In Mexico, and I know there's practices in place in California, but is that the case right now?
So definitely there are in Mexico, because Mexico is the third largest producer of milk in the continent, right? We have the United States first, then Brazil, and then Mexico. Mexico produces a lot of good milk. And a lot of milk in you know, Hidalgo and Aguascalientes is of very high quality. And it is normally actually used in the country. But Mexicans consume so much cream, so much nata, so much queso, that we have to bring milk from other parts of the world, mostly from the United States and from Canada, because we consume a lot of it. So Mexico has a normativa, which, you know, sort of sets the standards for milk, is a very good standard. And the only thing is that there are a lot of forces, I'm just going to call them forces at the moment, which are always pushing for those regulations to be watered down so that they can give us worse products, but still call it milk or still call it queso. And so that is what the battle is, not only in Mexico, but also in Guatemala and El Salvador. Some of the battle in the United States is trying to figure out how to protect that good quality that we're talking about. Mexico is a good place for regulation. Mexico is a place that has all of the regulations. The big problem in Mexico is that no one is paying attention of those regulations, right? It's not like we are lacking rules. We have other rules. It's just no one is enforcing them.
And what can we do about that? Nothing?
We can do a ton about it. And so on both sides of the border, I think the first thing is consumers need to demand better quality. Consumers drive this, right? If we eat whatever, you know, is put in front of us and we never ask where it's coming from and we don't ask, you know, how the animals are treated or what those animals are eating, then they're going to give us whatever stuff there is. But if we're actually always asking, the supply chain is trying to cater to us. And so that is very easy to get it. That's why in Mexico, ironically, you know, the people that we think that may be eating the worst, you know, the poor people in the towns or people that are, you know, still working next to their farms are eating actually quite better than the people in the cities, right? Because they have the connection to that farm, to that quality, as opposed to the people that, you know, maybe are buying at a big supermarket and they just don't know what the quality is and they're never asking. But because, you know, it is, you know, packed beautifully, and you know, it is half in English, half in Spanish, and it has a seal of approval of whoever. You know, people think that is quality, but actually that is not quality. So I think the consumer can do a lot, and in dairy is a huge thing. As I said, you know, we eat so much dairy in Mexico. If we demand better quality, it's easy to get there because it's not that difficult to take care of an animal that is producing milk. You know, growing a vegetable is a little bit more, it's a little bit harder because you plan today and you hope that, you know, it rains, it doesn't dry, it doesn't freeze, you know, all these things. And you're going to get that lechuga, those rabanos, you know, in like 2-3 weeks, maybe 7 months. Whereas milk is like, you know, that cow ate yesterday and it gave you milk today. So it is quite fast that we see the value and the quality of what the animal is eating in the production of the milk that, you know, that we're drinking and then what we're using.
So how do we go from good milk to cheese?
So once you have milk, you know, you have beautiful raw milk.
Unpasteurized
raw, leche cruda, bronca. Because of the regulation that exists in Mexico, if you're going to make a cheese that is going to be aged under 60 days, you know, a queso fresco, a panela that is going to be sold really fast, maybe 1 week after it's made, maybe you know, 2 weeks after it's made, it has to be made with pasteurized milk. If you're aging that cheese past 60 days, so 2 months, then you can use actually raw milk. So there are raw milk cheeses in Mexico. Queso Cotija de la Región de Origen, you know, the one that is made in Michoacán, is made with raw milk. And it is made possible that way because it has to be aged at least for 60 days. You really can find good quality Cotija from the mountain that is younger than 90 days, right? But the panela is not the same. The panela that we are going to eat maybe was made today and is going to be sold in, you know, next week or maybe in 2 days in the mercado, that has to be by regulation made with pasteurized milk. That doesn't mean that...
And how do you make it? How do you get that wonderful silkiness with the panela?
Well, I mean, one thing, Mom, should we start, though, with cremas and then move up to cheeses? So, because I think that would be the gradual... Sure. Evolution, no, Carlos? Let's do that, Mom. Okay. That way we can see, like, you get the milk, we make crema, then cheese comes from out. Let's do that, no?
Yeah, that's a good idea.
So let's say you have good quality milk, right? And you want crema. And so crema is basically, you know, the fattest part of that milk. So there is two ways that you can make it. One is by natural acidification. So that means that, you know, the milk that you have that is raw, it starts acidifying by itself. You know, it starts fermenting by itself. And then you remove that sort of acidified nata, you know, and then you liquefy it and you make crema. There's a process also that is technical. You can add citric acid into that milk to turn it really fast. And that's what normally happens now. You know, people pasteurize the milk and then they put citric acid, which could be, you know, in powder form. People in the pueblos normally use vinegar or lime juice to make their own crema. But, you know, the big industry is making it with citric acid. And so then you create that sort of fat. You separate that fat and then you liquefy it, and that's how you end up with crema. Now, here the problem is...
How do you liquefy it?
You liquefy it by putting a little bit of the whey back and just putting it in a centrifuge. You know, it's just like, you know, if you're making it at home, you can just put it in your blender and, you know, centrifuge it and you end up with it. Now, the problem is that in Mexico, a lot of people have the memory of crema that is very thick, right? Crema espesa. And then they seem to not be able to find it. And the reason is because the milk quality has gone down. So it doesn't have that same amount of fat. And so we're, you know, the industry is making crema with milk that is of lower quality. And so it's not so thick, not so espesa. And so what ends up happening is that now a lot of producers are using gomas and powders and all sorts of stuff to add to create that sort of texture. And so,
body.
To that body. And that just tastes horrible. I mean, yeah. I when I go to the supermercado in Mexico and I buy that, I'm always like, oh, this just doesn't taste good. You know, it has that sort of like sort of rancid flavor at the end.
Yeah.
And it's from those, from all those chemicals added to create something that before was being just done by quality milk.
So we have like a really like something very liso, very smooth, like a crema mexicana, and then you get something like a crema salvadoreña, which is thicker. How does that process get? They just add more fat, and the consistency is denser, or how does that work?
Yeah, exactly that.
So it's just more fat.
It's just pure fat. You know, if you want something more thick, you put less whey to liquefy it, and you end up with something fatter. Also, you have to think that, you know, crema in Mexico actually changes, right? Like the crema from Puebla is not the same crema from Chiapas. You know, the Chiapanecos like to eat their crema very, very thick on top of tamales. Whereas, you know, if you're putting in enchiladas in Puebla, you want sort of something that is more silky, more watery. And so they put more whey on it to make it more liquid. And so it is always a said crema, but what I think is interesting for people to know and is that acidification is coming from a process that normally was made, you know, by normal fermentation, and now is made by, you know, adding a fermentation process, which is again citric acid or vinagre or
lime.
Okay, so then you take the leftover whey. Is this the time to talk about requesón?
Yeah, I think this is a good time to talk about requesón. I think that's a great idea.
Exactly.
So, you know, so is it correct to liken it to ricotta? Because what ricotta means recooked, right? Recooked in Italian, no? So how can we make that distinction?
So this is, I think, fascinating, right? Like ricotta means twice cooked and requesón means, you know, dos veces cocido, right? And so why is it so different, right? Like normally we think, why is this so different that requesón and ricotta are not the same? The issue is that ricotta in Italy is normally being made with full fat milk, right? Not just whey, actually. It has full fat milk and they are recooking that. And so the ricotta ends up being more heavy. Whereas in Mexico or most of Central America, Mexican Central America, we're using just the whey. So you already took part of the fat to make butter, or you already did it to the crema, right? And so you end up with a whey that is lower in fat. And so when you're turning that into requesón, it is going to be a less creamy. And so it changes profiles, but it's the same process. It's just a different process. We actually at Lactography, and this is not an ad for myself, but we sell both ricotta de leche or requesón de leche and requesón de suero. So we sell both, you know, made with milk and made with whey, and it depends on really what you want.
We want you to do an ad for yourself, okay? This is the time to be Mexican and promote yourself and your businesses, because you're doing a very valiant mission, and I think it's important for everyone that's listening to understand that. So please, do not feel bad about telling what you offer and how you sell it, because I think this is really, eso es lo que se trata, lo que estamos haciendo, ¿no?
Gracias.
So, yeah, so the beautiful thing about requesón and understanding the distinction of it, I think you did a beautiful job defining that, ¿no? So let's talk. What do you want? You want to talk about panela, mommy? Because I know that you already touched upon it. You seem very passionate about it. I think one of the things that I would like to kind of make the distinction is, because I'm a big fan, obviously, of Oaxaca, and the idea of queso panela being likened to mozzarella or queso de hebra, I would like to really kind of maybe dive a little bit deeper and find out what those lines are. Please, Carlos. Right.
And so I'm very happy to talk about this. I do think that we're missing one product still in the middle of these two, which is a cuajada.
Please, go ahead.
Right? And
cuajada.
Right, Sarela? So cuajada is such an important thing. And people normally forget that cuajada is a whole dairy product that exists in Mexico that is used for so many things, right? And so if you're making salsa de crema, you're not putting milk, you're actually putting cuajada. You already had to churn some of the milk. You also can make it into a dessert, into torrejas. You can also use it to make cookies, right? So this cuajada is such an important thing. But the problem is that because it goes bad so fast, most people cannot buy it in the supermarket. And so you either go to the mercado and buy it there, or you just end up using, you know, queso crema or, you know, some other type of products that cuajada, not cuajada anymore. So I think...
So let's try to define cuajada in English for our Anglo listening audience, please. So how can we best describe that, please?
So I think people in Wisconsin... we'll understand this better. But let's say, you know, you start to making cheese, and once you make that cheese, you know, the milk solidifies and it becomes kind of a gel, right? And then you cut that whey, cut that gel, and you separate the whey from the curd. Now that curd, right, is cuajada. Uh-huh. In Wisconsin, what they end up doing is they put salt into it and they make salty curds, you know, the chewy curds. And then they fry it, right? And so that is cuajada. But cuajada that has not salt added, that is just a sort of fresh curd, is what cuajada is. But as you can imagine, that product goes bad so fast, but it has that sort of milky, lactic, a little bit of sour, a little bit acidic taste to it that is so unique. But for that, to be able to have that, you have to be making cheese yourself.
Yeah. Is that like what they call hoop cheese?
Yes, exactly. So hoop cheese, you know, queso de granja, you know, is that sort of first step before you... It's just a very simple cheese that you just took the curd out, put it in the hoop, and that's it, right? You didn't press it, you didn't mill it, you didn't wrap it in any type of... leaf, because that will change the flavor and it will also change the acidification. So cuajada is that very specific type of thing. And these quesos, you know, the hoop cheese, queso fresco, queso de rancho, queso de hoja, are all cheeses that are normally used in Mexico, or at least in southern Mexico, you know, Oaxaca, Veracruz, Chiapas, for breakfast. And the reason to use those cheeses for breakfast is that those cheeses were being made, that was milk in the early morning at 5 a.m. They turned into cheese, and then they sell that really fast, and that gives the producer of milk some quick cash. And that was so important for people in the mercados, right? To be able to sell something and have cash right away, because they have to buy, you know, salt, or they have to buy, you know, supplements for their animals, or they have to just eat themselves, right? So this is a whole part of the culture in Mexico that we're losing as, you know, less people are in subsistence farming. You know, people don't need maybe money that right away anymore, and so but we're losing some of that culture of morning cheeses, of dairy products of the morning.
And I think it's important to mention that, you know, I think queso fresco is the most popular, it's the most consumed cheese in Mexico, right? Queso fresco, no? And you know, I've worked with Cacique for many years, you know, for 10 years plus, and I think they do a great job as far as trying to bring things to the masses. You know, Carlos, you probably have your own opinions about that, but we won't really necessarily get into that. But
I have no bad opinion on that. I think you are a great ambassador of cheese, and I thank you for having introduced some good cheese to the U.S. audience. I think that there's no purist moment here. I think people just need to eat better.
Yeah.
This episode is brought to you by Tabard Inn. Tabard Inn, Washington, D.C.'s quintessential hotel, is located on a quiet, tree-lined street just 5 blocks from the White House. Vibrant yet unassuming, the Tabard is comprised of 35 sleeping rooms, each unique in character and design. Feast on an eclectic American cuisine in their acclaimed restaurant, or enjoy a cocktail served on the beautiful patio, which has ample room for social distancing. travelers from around the world find the Tabard the only place to stay when taking their travels to Washington. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
You know that at the ranch, every lunch, we had asadero, you know, because we used to make it, and they would bring it to the table in the iron pan, and they would serve it to us at a tortilla, you know, the hebra. So how is that made?
So I think this is the perfect segue, you know, asadero, and then coming back to the question from Aaron, talking about, you know, queso Oaxaca. And so let me go back to, you know, ancient times, to Armenia, you know, in sort of Middle East Europe. So there is a type of cheese, a family of cheese called pulled curd in English. It's better known for its name in Italian, that is pasta filata. In Spanish is pasta hilada. So this is a whole family of cheeses. And so people are familiar with this family of cheeses because they know provolone, mozzarella, and burrata from Italy. But the original cheese is from Armenia. One of the first ones of this style is from Armenia. These cheeses exist of pasta filata, which is a sort of like, you know, that you can make evra, the stringiness. There's some in Spain, there's some in France. And then, of course, this travels into the Americas. And almost half of the countries in Latin America have a pasta hilada cheese. So in Mexico, we have two. We have asadero and queso Oaxaca, which is actually queso de hebra. In Colombia, it's called queso paipa. In Venezuela, it's called queso de mano. This style of cheese actually exists in a lot. In Argentina, it's called provoleta, actually. So this is a big family of cheese. Now, what is so interesting about making this cheese is that, again, we go back to the bat. You know, we do the gel, and we cut the curd. And we take some of that whey out. And the whey that we're taking out, we're adding warm water. And so that warm water starts to melt the curd. And so that's when the moment, you know, at the right pH, which is 5.5, the right pH, the curd starts kind of melting away. And that's the moment that you can grab that curd and pull it. And so make that sort of like strings of cheese. And you can decide to make, you know, mozzarella or queso de hebra. Now, what is interesting between the differences between the two cheeses of Mexico that use this technique, one is asadero and the other one is queso de hebra. Asadero is made normally with milk that is fresh and has not been fermented. Whereas queso Oaxaca, in Oaxaca, in Reyesetla, which is where, you know, it originally kind of started, it is made with milk that has been partially skim, and the milk has sour. That's why queso Oaxaca, that has that tangy, sort of lactic, citrusy flavor at the end, because it has started to ferment. And it's also not super fat, because they have taken some of the fat away to use as cuajada, right? And also to use as crema. And so queso Oaxaca is so distinct, and what I think what has happened is that people have that memory, but now the big industry in Mexico is making queso Oaxaca with full cream, with non-acidification, and so you end up with a Oaxaca that is kind of rubbery, right? It is like hard, you know, it's really chewy, and the original Oaxaca is not like that. And the reason is this thing is that, you know, it was a milk that has already been pre-processed, because producers, you know, the dairy people need to maximize the amount of milk that they have to be able to make the most money out of just the 1 liter or the 10 liters that they have.
Yeah, I think that's I think that's very important, and I think the idea of being able to make that distinction, as you said, of the asadero, because it's something that's very, I think, fond, and we have great memories of it in the North, because you don't really see asadero in many other parts, and for me at least, you can find it in other parts of Mexico, but for me it's very Northern, right? And then the idea of queso Oaxaca. But I think that also brings us to the idea of the artisanal cheeses and the Spanish influence that came to Mexico and how cheese started changing. So I would love to be able to talk about that and be able, Carlos, to sort of bridge those, the new world and the old world, you know?
Sure. So the first thing is that, you know, there was no dairy animals in Mexico before the Spanish arrived, right? There was no culture of dairy, nothing at all. And so really cheese comes with the Spaniards. And the Spaniards are not known necessarily, or the Spaniards that came at the beginning are not necessarily known for cheeses made with cow's milk. They're known for cheeses made with sheep's milk. Right. So they're from Castilla-La Mancha in the center of Spain. And those are queso manchego, hombra, you know, artesano, you know, it's all those sheep's milk cheeses that are delicious. And, you know, they have a very distinct way of usage in Spain. So, you know, these people arrive and they brought their animals, and the cows that they brought weren't necessarily cows for milk. They were cows that are called doble propósito, you know, for two purposes. It is cows that you can eat as meat and you can also use for their milk, right? But that means that you're using both the male and the female, right? Because the males are good for nothing other than for eating meat. Really, if you're not creating meat, you really don't need the males for anything. You need one bull and maybe not even one anymore, you know, to make, you know, female cows that, you know, give you the milk. Anyway, so they arrive and they brought this culture of cheese making. But the first cheeses that appear in Mexico, still under the, you know, the colonial rule, are made with sheep's milk. And so the in my book, you know, I did all sorts of research on sort of the historical aspects. And the first cheese that appears in Mexico is in Puebla, and it is made with sheep's milk, so closer to a manchego from Spain. And then the indigenous peoples of Mexico were lactose intolerant because they didn't eat dairy past, you know, they were babies. Right? They didn't eat the enzyme in themselves, so their bodies stopped making it. So it took a long time for the indigenous peoples to actually start developing a tolerance for dairy and a liking for dairy, right? Some of the things that I have read from historians and also from some of the indigenous scholars say that also people of that time saw queso and, you know, all the dairy products as too close as pulque. And because pulque was really a ceremonial drink, right? It wasn't like, you know, they were going to be drinking dairy all the time. And so that creates this sort of like time lag between when the Spanish started making cheese and when the, you know, the Mexicans, you know, the people or the Americans in Mexico start actually eating cheese. So the first cheeses that we started making are, you know, all the ones that we have talked about, all the queso fresco, panela, and, you know, and it takes a long time for a development of other cultures of cheese. However, Mexico has, you know, other than blue cheese, which is really is the one style we don't make. We have quesos de montaña, we have hard cheeses, we have goat's milk cheeses, we have all sorts of other stuff that has been developing, you know, for the past 200 years. The scholars in the Universidad de Chapingo, who are the ones that have done the most research on this, you know, because my book is more sort of in cheese culture, but they have really done a lot of the technical research. They identified 60 traditional Mexican cheeses, of which we have already lost 20 of them. And what does it mean that we have lost them? That these cheeses are not being made anymore, but there's also no one that remembers how they're made. And so that means that we have lost them completely. And so there are, you know, we really need to share with the 40 cheeses that we still have, because they're going to go away if we don't start eating them.
And how come that we can't eat them here in the United States?
Oh, this is This is the most difficult part of this interview, I'm going to be here to tell you. And I'm going to come out and say, all right, the FDA, which is the one that regulates the food production and the entry of food into the United States, is racist, full-on racist. It has created all sorts of loopholes and rules and everything, so not single dairy product can come from Mexico. That is not the same for other countries in Latin America. It is just pure, like, don't liking, you know, Mexican products and Mexican systems. And we have looked into this really closely because there's no reason why Mexico, that has a very good production of milk, cannot enter with its products to the United States. And so it basically has to do, you know, with this idea that, you know, things from Mexico are not...
Well, the lobbyists, I mean, Carlos, I mean, let's be honest, right? The people, you know, there's a lot of people behind dairy that are powerful, right? And exactly. I think that there's a little bit of that as well.
Yeah. So that and a little bit of, you know, chauvinism and, you know, good old racism, that nothing is as good as it is made in the other side of the border. Although, you know, there's like, you know, Mexican communities that have been in Texas for, you know, the past 200 years and they have eaten dairy as well. So, you know... And that's why we don't find them in the United States. Now, there are products made in the United States by people that have either migrated to the United States or that they're second generation, third generation, and they're making dairy products. Also, there is this chauvinistic idea that anything coming from Mexico should be cheap. And good quality dairy is not cheap. It can be cheap. You know, if you're eating your animals correctly and you're treating them humanely and you're making a good product and paying your employees, it's never going to be cheap. And so that conception has to go away that, you know, because it's crema mexicana, it has to be cheap. It can be cheap if you use the worst ingredients. But if you want good product, like, you know, people eat in Mexico, it's going to be as expensive as the products that you're paying from Europe.
Yeah, anything else, you have to pay for good product, right? And I think that's interesting to mention because, you know, I think nowadays we're living in the era of the foodie. I think the pandemic has allowed people to be more informed about where their product comes from and seek out these very niche. And it's hard to say niche because Mexican cheeses have been around for so long, but we really encourage everyone that's listening to be able to go find that out. And hopefully we educated you guys and our audience as far as what to look for. I think that's very important. And I think, Carlos, you've done such an eloquent job of being able to explain that. And I think we need to continue to do that and educate ourselves about where our cheeses are coming from. And ask for Mexican cheeses. And ask why can't we procure them? Why can't we get them?
And I think the moment that people start hearing the cheese counter, you know, for more people, I want Mexican cheese. And not only Mexican cheese, that you want, you know, Honduran and cheeses from Colombia or cheeses from Uruguay. People are going to start paying attention. It's like maybe there is now a market that is willing to pay. And so those products are going to start coming. Because once you have the demand, there's nothing you can do. Like, you know, people will find to bring it. And if we're bringing to the United States, you know, products from Australia, you know, dairy products from Australia, there is just no reason why there's no dairy products from Mexico.
I want to cover two cheeses before we end, because the time is running and, you know, and we haven't talked about Mennonite cheese and we haven't talked about panela.
So panela is a cheese that is very simple because it doesn't require more than cutting out the curd and then hooping that cheese and then lightly pressing it. The cheese gets lightly salted by putting salt on top of the cheese. And so it is a cheese that benefits from full cream, from full fat in the milk. And so it has that sort of creamy, silky flavor. And normally it doesn't have that much salt, but it has some salt that is used for the sort of preservation of the cheese. Because if you don't put salt, you know, it starts decaying and it starts going bad. So salt acts as a preservative. The second cheese that you ask is Mennonite cheese. And so the Mennonite cheese, I think, is a wonderful, wonderful story. You know, the Mennonites arrived to the United States and Canada, being prosecuted in Europe because their religious beliefs. And then once they arrive in the United States, they are still persecuted for their religious beliefs, and so they need to emigrate. And so Mexico gives them asylum in the north. And so they move to Chihuahua, and they arrive and settle in two communities, which is Ciudad Cuauhtémoc and Ciudad Victoria in Chihuahua. And they are, they bring their culture and their language. And if you go right now to the Mennonites communities in northern Mexico, they still speak in their language. And they only deal with you if you make an attempt to try to speak with them in their own language. Some of them now also speak Spanish, but it's not most of them that speak Spanish. Most of them will, all of them will speak their own language, and some of them will speak either Spanish or English, depending also on where they are. So they make a type of cheese that they brought from the Netherlands, which is where they're original from. And this cheese is one that is, you need high fat in the milk. It's a cheese. It's a curd that is fermented after it has been curdled. So once you cut it, you let it ferment, and so it builds acidity, and so it creates that sort of sharp flavor that we think of cheddar, for example. And so then that cheese gets put into the mold, and it gets pressed, and it's in that pressing that you create the texture of the cheese, and then it gets salted by putting it in a brine. So instead of putting salt on top, like in the panela that I was explaining, this one is you put the wheel of cheese into a brine salt, which is 10% salt, 90% water. And so that is how you get salted. And so that's what Mennonite cheese. Normally cheese, dairy and cheese is the work of the men of the community in Mennonite communities. And then women normally tend to, the vegetable crops and all those things. But they also make fermented products. So, sauerkraut and other pickles that are originally from their culture are made by women. And so normally, if you go buy from them, they will give you, a piece of cheese, Mennonite cheese, and then a fermented food, maybe an onion, maybe some cabbage, to eat along. That's how they eat it. Of course, it's a cheese that melts really well. And so in the north of Mexico, it's all used for quesadillas in tortillas de harina.
Well, Carlos, thank you so much. I mean, the time has just gone away. And I think we can definitely come back and visit some more personalized cheeses and maybe some of the more unique ones from different smaller pockets in Mexico and Latin America. I think we can't limit ourselves just to Mexico. And we'd love to have you back to continue this charla, as they say, or this conversation. I think it's been absolutely phenomenal. How can our listeners be able to engage with you? Do you have a website, an email that you feel comfortable extending?
Sure, of course. Thank you. Thank you for the invitation, of course. People can find our company in Mexico. It's called Lactography. And, we sell cheese in Mexico City, and you can order from us, and, we'll deliver to your house in Mexico City. And then if you're looking for me, you can just look Carlos Yescas. It doesn't matter where, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, I think even TikTok. And so you can find me there and ask me questions. I love to chat about cheese. I love talking about dairy and Mexico and all these wonderful things. So thank you so much for having me, Sarela and Aaron.
Of course. So today we've been talking about all things Mexican dairy. Of course, we've covered a lot of subject matter with cremas, requesones, panelas, artisanal cheese. Our guests have been, of course, the incomparable Carlos Yescas. He continues to do this really beautiful work promoting Mexican cheeses, and he has these beautiful companies that will allow you to have the cheeses come to you as well. This has been an absolute pleasure. I hope everyone's enjoyed this. Of course, this is Cooking in Mexican from A to Z on Heritage Radio Network, and I know Carlos also has his platform there as well, so please seek him out as well. And muchísimas gracias. Estamos muy agradecidos. Gracias.
Cooking in Mexican from A to Z is powered by Simple Cast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you.
For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without your support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like. Tell your friends and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey everybody, I'm Nick Latham.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.